our speaker today is going to be talking about penstemons, the nearly perfect perennial for any garden in the West. And our speaker today is Bob Pennington. Bob bought and revived a defunct plant nursery in 1975, knowing very little about business in general or growing plants for sale at the time that they started. And it's still the nursery that he continues to run today, and it's very successful. And he has joked with me that, well, I'm not sure how much of a joke, maybe he'll tell us later, but he says probably his knowing so little about what he was doing was the key to his success. So we'll see about that. Bob is a past president of the American Penstemon Society and a founding member and past president of the Santa Fe Botanical Garden. He's a current board member of the Areogonum Society and a general plant geek, which I can relate to, with no formal plant education. He's a husband, father, and grandfather, and a renowned speaker about all things plant. So we're lucky to have him with us today. Welcome, Bob. How are you today?
I'm just fabulous. I'll get better, however. Sorry, Tom Hartman, but I love that line.
Excellent. All right. So do you really think it's true that it's a key to your success that you didn't know about those things, I have to ask?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, I do. You know, when we started, the convention was, well, you know, nobody bought perennials. Nobody bought native shrubs. And we didn't know better, so we grew in anyway. And we slowly, over time, developed a considerable following and a market for these things. And then a few years later, perennials became very popular again. And we were already doing it. We didn't have to invent the wheel when the demand came.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think so. Excellent. You know, we just did what felt right, and it turned out to be right.
Yeah, definitely. So I have been asking the speakers in this series about how they got introduced to gardening. You know, a lot of people, it was through their grandparents or not until during college or this or that. It sounds like, well, I guess just because you hadn't known about growing plants for sale doesn't mean you weren't already a gardener. So can you speak?
Well, yeah, when I was a little kid, I remember we had fabulous gardens out in the High Plains, eastern Colorado. Lived in a little town called Flagler, and, you know, it's a whole lot like Santa Fe in some ways. It was incredibly dry and hot in the summer and cold in the winter and all that good stuff. But I do remember we had beautiful gardens, but I didn't have anything to do with them except to eat the food and look at the flowers. But, you know, it is a memory.
Yeah.
But as far as actually growing things, well, right before we moved to Santa Fe to buy the nursery, we had a vegetable garden or two up in Colorado in Thornton. But, you know, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in college, most of my roommates were forestry majors, and they had to take classes in all that good stuff, you know, taxonomy and whatnot. But I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed some really valuable learning, but oh well, that's the way it is.
You've probably made up for
but
it.
But no, then. I'd say, you know, I made up for it one way or another.
Yeah.
You know, we jumped into this. The story goes that, you know, when I was doing social work in Denver, and I hated it, and I called my dad and asked if there were any opportunities in Santa Fe. And he said he'd look in the paper, and he called back an hour later and said, "How'd you like to run a nursery?" And I didn't say anything. And he said, "Plants, not kids." And I said, "Why the heck not?" So we moved down, we opened the nursery, and the rest is history.
Wow, that's great. And for everyone listening who may not know, the name of the nursery Bob owns is Agua Fria. And I believe that's named after the street it's situated on, right?
Yeah, conveniently, it is located right here on Agua Fria Street in Santa Fe. That's correct.
That's a good name.
So, you know, it just so happens to be first in the alphabet, but
That doesn't hurt. Yep, I waltzed into Bob's nursery this spring and started talking to him about this online educational series for the West, and he asked me why I didn't have any New Mexicans in it. And I said, well, I sure would like to. And so that's how we arranged today's call, in short.
Well, there we are.
Yeah. So then, Bob, we'll dig into the depths of the presentation really soon, but let me first ask you how you came to be so passionate about Penstemon, from starting out as a nursery and not really knowing what you're doing to being president of the Penstemon Society.
Well, that's a different story, but, you know, there's always a story to everything. But as far as Penstemons themselves, you know, I don't really know. I think that they just appealed to me. I think probably the Penstemon Barbatus, you know, with this big red flower, was probably the first one that really appealed to me. And I just like bright, bold colors, and Penstemon Barbatus is bright and bold and red. So there you go. I just like the way it looked.
Excellent.
And we grew that and one or two others, and they grew. And that was probably the real secret, is that, you know, the first ones we played with grew.
Yep.
And so any plant that will actually grow is a good plant, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. Yeah. And so,
yeah, but
also real quick for folks who may not be as familiar with Santa Fe as you and I, especially you, because we have listeners all the way up through Montana and everything.
Yep.
Tell us what your elevation is there.
We are located at almost 7,000 feet. You know, I mean, that's the official height, but the nursery is at 6,890 feet. So that's high enough. You know, and that's part of what makes growing things here both a pleasure and a treat, is that, you know, it's almost 7,000 feet elevation, but it's also, you know, 35 degrees north. So it's a combination of latitude and altitude that gives us our challenge. Our climate is very similar to Denver's, except that we don't have the violent swings that Denver has. You know, it takes longer to get as hot, and it doesn't cool off as fast. And we don't have as much wind, but that's the big difference between here and Denver. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our soils are mostly sandy silts. People think that when they move here, they always think that they're growing in clay soils. Mm-hmm. But that's just because they're really, really hard adobes, but they're more sand than they are clay.
Okay.
So it actually grows good plants.
Yeah.
Amazingly good stuff.
Right.
Easily.
Excellent.
If you could find water.
Yeah.
Water is always the issue.
Right. Okay. I want you to hold that thought. First, real quick, tell us what USDA hardiness zone you're considered to be at there.
Well, when we started the nursery back in the old foggy days, we were in zone 5. And we routinely got to 20 below zero during the winter. Now I guess we're 6A or 6B, and we're in the sunset system, which I think is a lot more useful. We're in 3A or 3B, one or the other, depends. It varies.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that the sunset system is a lot more rational. You know, if you got 24 systems or zones for the Western United States, plus special ones for other places,
right?
You know, it's a lot more definable.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. On the one hand, I used to live in California and used it there, and the very first speaker I interviewed back in the spring, Cheryl Moore Goff, talked to us a bunch about the different zones and the pros and cons. And what we discussed was that it doesn't seem specific enough for the Mountain West because of our elevation, or the interior West, I should say, because of the elevational change. And it's really well detailed through California, but then it seems like it kind of peters out where Colorado has only 3 different zones in the whole state or something.
Well, that does push it a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
It absolutely does. And the same is true in New Mexico. I forget exactly how many zones we have, but But there's an awful lot more to it than just maximum and minimum temperatures. The difference between Albuquerque and parts of Santa Fe, is ridiculous. There are things that will grow in parts of Albuquerque, which technically are likely to be colder any given night than Santa Fe, even though it's 2,000 feet lower. But they're in the river drainage, and so they actually get colder. But they can grow things that we can't grow because it's too cold here.
Wow.
Things like pampas grass, I don't want to grow it anyway, but, it thrives in the Albuquerque Valley, whereas it will not grow in Santa Fe worth a hoot.
Yeah.
And I think the fact is that it may get colder in, say, Corrales, but it will be a lot shorter duration cold.
Oh, uh-huh.
So, that alone makes a difference for a lot of plants.
Definitely.
Not how cold it gets, but how long it's cold.
Right. So, anyone listening who wants a more in-depth discussion about microclimates and hardiness zones and all of this, look back to the Secrets to Beautiful, Easy, and Sustainable Gardening in the West series, and you can buy it individually. And for now, let's focus on penstemon, Bob, shall we?
Okay.
All right.
Sure.
So you already mentioned water and we talked about the fact that they're native. So
yep.
We could go with either one of those. Maybe you want to just say a real quick thing about what's relevant about it, penstemon being Native American plant.
Okay.
And what's important about that.
Well, I would say that, first of all, it's a huge genus. There are some 280-plus species of penstemons, and then a few penstemons have a lot of varieties, but plus just a plethora of hybrids, but that's another story. But basically what it means is that they're anywhere in the western United States, pretty much, there are penstemons that occur naturally, except perhaps Death Valley is one of the few places with none. But, there are some pretty darn close to the bottom of the valley, too, and they're really beautiful. But the real issue is that there is a species which grows somewhere near you naturally. And the interesting thing is that many, many others are highly adaptable. A friend of mine, for instance, that lives in South Denver, has been growing a species called Eximia, which is actually from Baja and grows 5 to 6 feet tall. And he's been able to get it through a couple of winters in Denver with no exceptional protection. And what that really, I think the reason is that most penstemons have evolved had differentiated fairly recently in terms of history, and that they still retain basic hardiness from their origins, which evidently is probably in Utah. So they've evolved in Utah and then spread out all over from that point. There's probably 60 species still occur naturally in Utah, which is, I think, the highest single concentration of any individual state. But it's a pretty amazing plant. And it is highly adaptable. Most penstemons thrive in bright sun. Most penstemons thrive in lean soils and certainly thrive with minimal water. There's very, very few that thrive in absolutely no water. And, very few of them have very, very specific soil needs. So they're pretty adaptable as long as they don't stay soggy. There are penstemons that grow in the forests, both in the eastern United States and in the Pacific Northwest. But they're not the majority. The bulk of species actually occur in what we call the Intermountain West.
Great.
So that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, that's perfect, since that's where we are, you and I, and I assume most, if not all, of our listeners. So.
Well, you never know about that.
That's true. And I have tried to look up how many species of penstemon are native to Colorado, and from what I found, it was right around 60 also. Do you know offhand?
Yeah, it's somewhere in that 50-60 range. It, uh-huh. And it varies from year to year, and depending on who's counting them and who's, you know, things like that. And there are several in the western Colorado that are very, very rare and threatened. And, of course, the oil shale development's a big risk for some of those because they grow only in specialized. Debilis, for instance, only grows in the oil shale cliffs out there near Rifle, and that's about the only place they exist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they do too much exploration, they could threaten them. But, you know, there are others that are very, very rare, and whether they exist in Utah or and Colorado or only Utah, well, you know, depends on an explorer's luck, I think.
Right.
But, yeah, it's close to 60.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, an interesting side note is I have read recently that different sources say there's a different number of 14,000-foot mountains in the state of Colorado, and I was thinking, how the heck would that ever change?
Wow.
But,
mountains erode, mountains grow, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it actually said that the definition of a mountain or a peak is variable.
Yep.
You know, is that one mountain with five different mini peaks considered one mountain, or, you know, so anyway.
Well, there you go.
It's interesting.
Look at
how
one
variable.
Like Mount Massive. It's a huge block of rock, and how many peaks does it have? I don't know.
Right.
But, yeah, you're right.
So, yeah, things are variable. And then they moved the Four Corners also, or they realized it was placed at the wrong place. You heard about that, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
it was a big deal.
That's funny, yeah.
Yeah, we had to move the whole thing a few feet one way or another, you know.
Right.
But, yeah.
So I was hoping, Bob, that you might tell us a little bit about your favorite penstemons for each niche. You said that they can grow tall ones, short ones. They grow in arid areas, moist, hot, cold.
Yeah.
I realize off the cuff it might be a little challenging, but if you wanted to talk about even just your five favorites in general and then tell us about their conditions, I thought that might
okay.
be fun.
Well, you know, of course, I mentioned penstemon barbatus, which is the prototype red penstemon, and very, very adaptable and very tough, and, you know, grows in Arizona, California, well, not California, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, anyway, and performs quite well in a number of environments. Now, right now, one of my personal favorites would be penstemon thompsonii, and we're tentatively calling it variety maybe jaegeri. And I say maybe jaegeri because, you know, I had first become familiar with penstemon thompsonii, which is one of these, 2-inch tall guys, girls I should say, since it's named for a woman, that occurs near Ely, Utah, which, by the way, is kind of the epicenter White Pine County. If you want to see a lot of penstemons in a good year, there are like 20 species that occur in that one county. And, you know, it's like the spot if you know where to look, and you're there in a good year. But in any case, that's where I first encountered thompsonii. And then when we were traveling south, we were near in Lincoln County, and encountered this other plant that, you know, it sort of resembled thompsonii, but it didn't look right, and it was bigger, and it's a definite, you know, some penstemons have a specific season. They only bloom at a certain time of year no matter what. Well, thompsonii is a real opportunity. If it rains, it'll bloom again, which makes it really attractive. But so I collected samples of this plant, which I had misidentified originally, and sent them off to Noel Holmgren at the New York Botanic Garden. And he said, yeah, it's thompsonii, and perhaps it's jaegeri, whereupon I did write an article for the American Penstemon Society Journal about penstemon thompsonii maybe Jaegeri. And, you know, if in fact that's what it is, then the range of this particular plant has been increased by at least 100 miles, because it had previously only been known to occur over in the west of Las Vegas. And, you know, if indeed when Noel finally gets around to the technical keying out that it turns out to be Jaegeri, it's moved. So that's one of my favorites for personal reasons.
Okay, and did you tell us what it looks like?
Yeah. Yeah, well, the foliage is really a gray-green thing. It's not specifically a mat, but it generally only grows a couple of inches tall. And it has very purplish flowers, which are perhaps, half an inch long. But it is, as I said, a real opportunist. I have seen this plant in bloom in the wild in the same spot in some years in June and as late as mid-October, which is a huge bloom cycle, you know, potentially for any penstemon. Most of them have 2-3 weeks of peak bloom, and that's it. There are a couple of others which have very long seasons. Two of them would be Penstemon rostiflorus, also known as Bridges, which is a tall, semi-shrubby red penstemon. Superficially looks a lot like Barbatus, but it can bloom from midsummer till killing frost, and that makes it a real long bloomer. And also Penstemon pinnifolius, which is very common. You know, people grow it all over the place. Originally, it's from parts of the high country of southern Arizona and southern New Mexico, but it's being grown everywhere on this planet, so far as I know. And it blooms for a tremendous period of time.
And that would be both the red and the yellow variety?
The red is the dominant. There is a yellow variant. And, you know, most red plants can produce a yellow analog, I guess you would call it. So, you know, if you got a red flowering plant, occasionally you'll see a yellow bloom. But people have separated out a couple of times and given it different names. There's a yellow Barbatus, for instance, called Schooley's Yellow. But, I would say that Bridges, pinnifolius, Barbatus, Thompson and I are among my favorites. Probably Linarioides is another one of my real favorites. Mm-hmm. Linarioides is common in the Four Corners states plus Nevada. And, you know, it has a thin, needleish leaf, and the flowers vary from quite blue to pink, almost white. There are at least 4 or 5 recognized varieties, and those are all geographical distinctions. And, yeah, you're getting really fussy if you're trying to break it up too much. And I know there are a couple, like Plant Select has introduced one that they call Silverton, which is Linarioides choleridensis. And Silverton something or other, I forget what, but you know, it's pretty common in the trade, and that's really cool. And that eczemias that I was talking about early on, which is, you know, looks very much like Palmeri, except the flowers are a little whiter, and it potentially can grow 6 feet tall and has no business surviving here. I've never kept one through an entire winter. Mine did fine up until March last year. And then I think I made the mistake of watering it. And that killed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked at a nursery locally, and we sold Palmeri. And I know they said, they die in the nursery because of being overwatered. And they always told people
that's
who
true.
Took them home the easiest way to kill them is by watering them too much at all.
Yep, yeah. Yeah, Palmeri is a fantastic plant. It's, you know, unfortunately, the highway departments are using it in places that are way, way out of its normal range. So you can see it up in central Idaho now.
Wow.
You know, it's originally from Nevada and Utah, southern New Mexico and Arizona. but you can see it all over Colorado along highways. It's, you know, all over the place around Santa Fe, and it's not native here. But yeah, what the heck, it germinates, it grows. It's not long-lived penstemon center. Some live a long, long time, and some live at most a few years. And Palmeri is in that group that only lives 3-4 years at absolute best. But it seeds ridiculously well. So that's why it's used on for highway departments, because it just spreads all over the place on its own.
Yeah, I feel a little foolish right now because I've told people that I've seen it growing native or naturally on road cuts between Durango and Aztec, New Mexico. And
well, it's naturalized.
But it sounds like if the highways use it a lot, they may well have seeded it there.
They probably did. You know, it does grow natively in New Mexico, but only really down much further south, closer to, where is it? Between Carrizozo and Socorro. Is pretty much where it exists. And you know, that's pretty far south. But it has been used by highway departments and spread all over the place. Another penstemon that, well, there are several, but another one that comes to mind is Etonii, which is another one of the few red ones. Most penstemons are blue, but, you know, the red ones are all kind of standouts because they're just brilliant colors. But Etonii, again, has been planted all over Wyoming and Idaho. And, you know, it's a Four Corners creature by nature, but again, it reseeds real well, and so who cares, you know. The definition of native is somewhat nebulous. You know, we like to call Datura ridii a native plant, but we know darn well that it wasn't here 15, 20,000 years ago. It was brought north from Mexico by the native peoples. So, you know, what's a native?
Yeah, you talked that many years ago, right? Nothing was what it is now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess what we say at this point is if it existed here pre-Columbia, Columbus, it's a native.
Right.
But Palmeri has naturalized all over the West. Let's put it that way.
Yes. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, sounds good. So,
okay.
For folks who are thinking, "Wow, this sounds great, I'd love to grow some of these penstemon." And by the way, I just want to acknowledge that penstemon's common general name is beard tongue. Which you can see why when you look at it, but it doesn't seem very sophisticated to me.
Well, it alludes to one of the structures inside the flower. Well, actually, it may allude to two different ones. The throat on some penstemons is covered with for lack of a better term, woolly hairs. And then the staminode, which is one of those things that a penstemon has. It has four fertile stamens, and then the pent stamen, or the fifth stamen, if you will, is the one that may be bearded, and it's, you know, it's an identification characteristic between species, because the amount of fuzz or hair on that staminode varies from none at all to very, very dense and woolly. And I guess, you know, whether it's that hair or whether it's the hairs that may occur in the floor of the throat of the flower itself, you know, you take your pick. But I kind of like the staminode because that's more like a tongue sticking out.
Right.
And in some, it does definitely stick out of the flower and is covered with white woolly stuff. Penstemon Pachyphyllus congestus, for instance, it's like a impudent tongue stuck out into the world, just covered with white woolly stuff.
There you go.
So, you know.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. Thank you. I think that's helpful for people. And I've also, well, they're in the same family as snapdragons, and so I was thinking when we were talking about penstemon palmeri, which of course the common name is Palmer's penstemon, but it's also called what, wild pink snapdragon, I think. So there's a resemblance.
Well, there is absolutely a resemblance, except that the mouths of penstemons are open, and of course real snapdragons have closed mouths and you have to pinch them to make them open.
And talk. I love that.
Yeah, and talk. And the bumblebee forces it open and climbs around inside and does her business and then flies off again. But, you know, penstemons are designed, well, different ones are designed for pollination by different insects. This summer I was lucky enough to photograph two or three different insects pollinizing penstemons, and someday they'll go online at the Penstemon Society website, which, by the way, is www.apsdev.org. And if you really want to see great pictures of penstemons, I would recommend highly that you look on that site, because, you know, penstemon aficionados are not reluctant to show off their handiwork and show off their plants, and that's where to see them.
Excellent.
And, it's, you know, it's a useful website in any case, but it does contain a lot of pretty pictures.
Yep.
And maybe one day some of those pictures of mine will show up there, because if I can ever identify the bugs, I would like that. But, you know, the red penstemons are designed by, you know, co-evolution to be pollinized by hummingbirds. You know, if you see lists, they'll recommend that penstemons be planted for hummingbirds. Well, that's true if they're red.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not true if they're not red.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Andrea Wolf, who's a plant evolutionist and, you know, really, really smart lady from Ohio State, the red penstemons actually have found that, you know, hummingbirds are much more efficient pollinizers because they don't visit every flower in the garden like bees do. They only, for instance, go to the red flowers. So if all the red flowers blooming at any one moment in any one location are penstemons, they don't have to expend nearly as much energy manufacturing pollen, because the hummingbirds will go straight from one red-flowered penstemon to another red-flowered penstemon and transfer the pollen that way. So it's a matter of efficiency of energy, if you will.
Yeah, sounds good. So if we like hummingbirds around us, plant red penstemon.
Plant red penstemons.
And of course,
there are some that bloom very, very early in the season, Utahensis superbus. Neither one is, you know, Utahensis is typically one of those holy grail plants. Everybody wants it. It's not very easy to grow, and it's a beautiful corally pink. Superbus is far easier to grow, perhaps not terribly hardy. It is from Texas. But, you know, we've had it survive for a number of years at a time. Superbus, Ridii, those are both other good early blooming reds. And then, of course, there are Pinnifolius and Barbatus and Etonii, which are, you know, spring bloomers. And then you get in, again, you have the Pinnifolius and Bridges, which will last through all of the migrations to the south in the fall. And the Bridges, or Rostiflorus, you know, grows from pretty harsh environments at 6,000 or 7,000 feet in Utah, up to timberline in Nevada. So it will, you know, it'll grow over a huge range.
Wow.
It's very adaptable.
Great.
And one of the best for attracting hummingbirds. And it produces lots and lots of flowers, too.
Excellent. We like that.
Yep.
So someone who wants to just start out, they've never grown penstemon before, they go to their local nursery, they find a penstemon or two. I mean, obviously it depends on what variety they have, but can you just give any guidance as far as, I mean, I know you said many of them are adaptable, but is there soil preparation that they should think about as far as increasing drainage or any general rules?
Well, you know, if drainage is a problem, perhaps, although I'm really not convinced it works all that well. It doesn't around here anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if as long as you water and the water doesn't just stand for hours, you're probably okay.
Mm-hmm.
If the water's going to stand for hours, well, maybe you should be planting something else entirely. You know, a friend of mine who lives in Oregon will buy plants from us and take them home. But when she plants them near Portland, she starts by washing off every bit of the soil that she has on her nursery-grown plants because it holds water. And that's exactly what she needs to avoid when she plants them in Portland. She needs to plant them straight into her soil, which drains without the addition of peat moss or core or, you know, the bark or anything else that we might use in a soil mix to help us get through the day here. Mm-hmm. So you know, it depends. I think that's probably the best way to do it anywhere is bare root your plant and plant it in your soil. Mm-hmm. And then keep them pretty moist. But you know, most instruments just aren't that fussy. If you live in a place like Portland, that's probably a real concern. If you live in Durango or Santa Fe or Denver or Reno or Boise or whatever, I don't think it's that much of a big deal. Penstemons, generally speaking, grow summer, just flat difficult. Some are difficult to get started and some are always difficult. But, you know, you play. I have killed bajillions of plants in the pursuit of learning how to grow them. Yeah. So that, you know, that's not a distinction. And then there are the new modern hybrids. There's things like the Pikes Peak Purple and Red Rocks, which are hybrids, and, you know, they display what's called hybrid vigor. They're tough. You know, they bloom for a tremendous period of time. And there are actually hundreds and hundreds of hybrids, and thousands, I guess, actually. And, you know, in England, that's pretty much what everybody grows are these hybrid penstemons. And the ancestry of their hybrids are actually mostly from Guatemala. So they, you know, they're neotropical things that we can't grow here because it's too cold in the winter. But in England, where it rarely ever freezes at all, these neotropical things with huge, huge flowers do fabulously well.
Wow.
So, you know, you can grow penstemons over a huge range.
Yeah.
A lot of those, you know, Guatemalan huge flowered things, oh, they're gorgeous. There's one called, well, it's named for my family, but not me. You know, I want it, but I've never been able to get a hold of it. I saw it when I was in England, but bringing live plants back from England is a little tough.
So it's called what, Penningtonii?
Pennington's Pride, I think, or something like that. Huh. But, you know, it's not the most spectacular. A lot, the biggest ones are these humongous red and white flowers that, you know, they're as big as any foxglove flower.
Wow.
Which is another near relative.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can grow penstemons, I'd say, if you want to start with one or two and you don't know what to try. Probably in the Intermountain West, probably Strictus has got to be about the easiest one there is.
Mm-hmm.
And Strictus and perhaps Pinnifolius and, you know, Red Rocks, if you want to dabble in hybrids, you know, Red Rocks is great, or Pikes Peak. Those are both really, really good ones. Start with them and then branch out. And, you know, you can easily end up pretty quickly with 40 or 50 species. And, you know, you may or may not be able to find the plants you want, but you can join the Penstemon Society. And if you do that, you can get into the seed exchange. And usually that means there are seeds for, oh, anywhere over, well over 100 species most years available.
Wow. That's great. And how many, well, first let me go back and just comment on how easy you said it is to grow Penstemon Strictus. I transplanted one that a friend gave me, and it didn't get quite enough water at first, and it looked like it had died, and then I noticed new leaves pushing up from the base. So I always tell people never rip a plant of any kind out right away when it looks dead, because it might just be putting up leaves that are better suited for its new climate or new microclimate. Right?
Well, that's absolutely true and a valid observation. You know, it's, you know, you got to give plants a chance. Strictus is more or less a mountain penstemon, so it's not the most drought-tolerant penstemon you could grow anyway. But, it does grow in rocky, gritty soils, so I don't think that enriching the heck out of your soils is a particular advantage. I think good draining, gritty soils and adequate water are probably, more appropriate than anything. And there's some that clearly too much water is too much water, like that Eximius.
Yeah.
It's from Baja. It's not supposed to be wet when it's not supposed to be wet.
Right.
And maybe I can keep it alive this next year. I don't know. I hope so.
Good luck.
Yeah.
I remember reading in Bob Nold's book, High and Dry, about persimmon, and he said that they are drought-tolerant or xeric as long as they get water at the right time of year in their life cycle, and said that spring is when it's really important for them to get water. Do you agree with that, and is it true across the board?
No.
Okay. Tell us about that.
I would say that it probably depends on where the plant is from.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole series of plants we grow, including penstemons, that come from, say, southern New Mexico, southern Arizona, and those are what I call monsoon obligates.
Mm-hmm.
And agosticaes are in that group too. And then it's, when they really require water is when the monsoons are supposed to be happening,
mm-hmm.
which is definitely summer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you water them adequately during that monsoon cycle, then they really thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And, they probably, being from, Arizona, they also like a little winter snow, a little winter moisture. And, of course, most plants will get through the spring, except for the really disastrous springs, if they get winter snow.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly penstemons. There's a whole group that come mostly from the Pacific Northwest, which I've had real trouble with, including the Davidsonii and Fruticosis, Rupicola. These are all basically evergreen sub-shrubs. And they have beautiful flowers, but they're all supposed to be covered by snow in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been a real challenge for me because most of the time we just haven't had that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't do as well. During the summer they're quite content with very little water because, again, they're from, some of them will say, from parts of Oregon and California, where it doesn't rain all summer long,
mm-hmm.
But it does. They do get winter moisture, so I would say, if you can, figure out the origin of the plant and try and give it water of a similar cycle, that's probably even more important. But if you're growing Colorado penstemons, for instance, summer moisture or spring moisture. They need some because they were supposed to have winter snow,
mm-hmm.
which would get them through spring.
Right.
But if they have their roots well charged with moisture from the winter and early spring snow melt, then they probably can get through till summer rains.
Okay, great. And then, Bob, I have found that, actually, it's more in reading than in my personal experience because I'm lucky that
mm-hmm.
the deer don't come into my garden all that much. But it seems like from what I've heard and read, penstemon, for the most part, are not very deer-resistant. I mean, I know deer-resistant means not very much sometimes anyway.
deer-proof. I would say that, generally speaking, the plants themselves are not browsed heavily by anything. I have watched squirrels bite the flowers off of penstemons.
Oh.
I've also watched them bite off a flower and spit it out, and then bite off the next one and spit it out. Because they taste bad.
Oh.
And if you've ever spent much time cleaning penstemon seeds and then somehow end up with a finger in your mouth, you'll know why they don't eat them a lot, because they're very bitter.
Uh-huh.
They don't taste good. They have a real naturally bitter flavor. So, they're not going to be they're not going to be browsed to extinction. I have seen flowers pruned off,
mm-hmm.
but most of the flowers end up laying on the ground because they taste bad.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
you know, I will. Rabbits do eat the dried seeds in extreme situations. There is an undisclosed location where I have put cages over four penstemons out in the middle of a desert habitat in Nevada, and you know, this is so that I can collect the seed, because you know, many years, if I don't have the cages over these particular plants, you get out there and the rabbits devoured the dried seeds. But heck, if you were a jackrabbit out in the bottom of a playa in Nevada, you know, anything with a succulent moist seed has got to taste good.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And just as a general starter also for people, you mentioned those four species that would be a really great place for people to start. And I usually tell people, sometimes when I'm doing designs for people, I'll, you know, within reason, I'll guide them, but I'll say, you know, the nurseries have different penstemon all the time here. We don't always carry the same ones. And
so, well, that's for darn sure.
To find ones that look good to them, you know, that can substitute
absolutely
well in this sunny situation or whatever. So I think that can be a good place for people to start to go to your local nursery, see what they have, read the tags, see what matches with your situation, and just try it out. And then next time you go in, there may be different kinds, and start from there.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the variation is for a lot of reasons this year, but you're absolutely right. You know, you just, you got to visit frequently, number one. That's what you ought to do if you're buying perennials, period.
Yeah.
Come often.
Yeah.
Don't buy a whole summer's worth of stuff in May, because, you know, you're going to get all the stuff that's blooming in May,
right,
or you're going to get stuff that was forced in a hothouse, one or the other.
Yeah.
But if you go throughout the summer, you'll end up with a sequence that'll last all summer long.
Yeah.
And that's what you're really after. But, you know, some years you'll have a whole lot of something. The next year, they won't exist. And partly it's, well, like this year when I was out collecting seed, there just wasn't any.
Hmm.
You know, much in, you know, through most of Oregon, Nevada, Idaho, I guess that's where I did most of my collection so far this year, there was just very little because it was so darn dry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what did bloom, the rabbits ate the few seed heads that were there, you know, but basically they just didn't bloom. So next year we will have what, you know, is available more commercial,
mm-hmm,
and what's left over from previous years. Penstemon seeds do last a long time. The best germination we ever had on the sunset penstemon from Flagstaff was like 10 or 12 year old seed.
Wow.
So, you know, seeds actually get better with age for a couple of years.
Huh.
They do definitely after ripen. But yeah, you'll get different plants, different years, no question.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plants that, you know, some of the new hybrids are just really pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely play around and you have to experiment. You know, there are specialty plants like Penstemon nanus or Thompsonia that are only really probably at their best in rock gardens or troughs or something, because they're only an inch or two tall.
Mm-hmm. I have some of those varieties in my rock garden, and they're just great. They just creep out. You know, they're probably 8 inches wide in diameter by now after, I don't know, probably 4 years, and they just get covered with flowers in the spring, and the flowers are huge for how little the plants are. They're just stupendous.
True.
I love them. Yeah.
Yep. And, you know, there are others like Strictus, which can end up a couple of feet across.
Yeah.
You know, if it's really happy, and then, you know, there are companions to Strictus. I would say that if you're going to plant Penstemon Strictus, try to locate Penstemon neomexicanus, which looks very much the same, but usually begins to bloom almost at the moment that your Strictus declines.
Ah, I like that.
So if you plant the two of them real close together, you extended the season of that little patch by another 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, great.
So, you know, I mean, you know, they're not from the same area at all, but And the Strictus definitely looks much better in the winter than Neomexicanus does. You know, Strictus looks great fall, winter long. But Neomexicanus looks kind of dead in the winter.
It's not an evergreen one then, huh?
It's not an evergreen. It's not you know, markedly evergreen, let's put it that way.
And
or Strictus.
We haven't exactly touched on it, but a lot of penstemon are evergreen, right? They're foliage.
That's true.
What
yeah, or at like least evergreen basil rosettes.
Uh-huh.
You
like
know,
half?
The, you know, the,
half
yeah,
of all penstemon,
yeah.
Maybe?
Probably half of them are,
I think,
or
that's
more.
Cool. I think that's great.
Yeah, and some of them, you know, they change color a little bit in the winter, not as much as, say, Areogonums do, but penstemons are definitely, they have winter interest.
Yes. Great. Okay, so we have plants that have winter interest, are highly adaptable, can different varieties planted throughout, you know, will bloom throughout the season, so you can have a penstemon blooming in your garden throughout the entire season, one or another. And what else have we covered about them? Hummingbirds love some variety or another of them, the red ones. And
yep.
There's really, and the deer won't usually kill them, maybe browse them lightly.
Nope.
So, it yeah, like you said, the nearly perfect perennial for every Western.
Nearly
park.
Perfect.
I love it. So, Bob, if someone wants to learn more, obviously we have the Penstemon Society website, and then there, did you mention a couple books that you'd like to?
Well, yeah, Bob Nold's book, which you mentioned, which, and the name of that is Penstemons. It's from Timber Press. And, of course, that's probably one of the best general penstemon books out there. The Penstemon Society also published a book by Ellen Wilde and Dale Lindgren, and the name slips my mind, but if you look on the website, again, that is apsdev.org, that'll, you know, you can find the book referenced on there. And if you're an Intermountain penstemon freak or penstemonophile or penstemaniac, take your pick, you really need to own the Intermountain Flora Volume 4. It's not cheap. It's about $75. It comes from the New York Botanical Garden. But, you know, it basically identifies every penstemon in what Holmgren and Company have identified as the Intermountain West, which covers western Colorado and all of Utah and pretty much all of Nevada and little bits of Oregon and Idaho and Wyoming and the strip in Arizona anyway. So, you know, and that's penstemon heaven right there. I mean, that's where you're going to find the bulk of the species of this fabulous genus. And, you know, they're out there now. The one real shame is that in the old days, penstemon were in this fine family called the Scrophulariaceae, but the plant geneticists have screwed it up, and now penstemon, the family's gone through a typical family divorce, and now we're in the Plantagenaceae, which is, it means we're more, penstemons are more closely related to plantain than
yeah.
they, you know, the garden weed than they are to, say, paintbrush.
I did not know that, Bob.
Yep. It's one of those embarrassing things penstemons aren't real, penstemaniacs aren't real pleased with. But
yeah, I can imagine. Well, it's good to know. Set me straight.
Yeah, well. But, you know, if you call them Scrophulariaceae, you're still going to get away with it.
Yeah, I have so far. I teach up the Crested Bee
Well, just keep it up.
Festival every year, and
yeah,
I tell people all about that, and now I have to change it.
Yeah.
All
it's,
right.
It's rather embarrassing to be a Plantagenaceae, but what the heck.
Yeah, what can you do about it, huh?
Not much.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you so much for sharing your wealth
sure.
of information about the nearly perfect perennial. It was such
well,
a
all righty.
Talking with you, and if anyone is in the Santa Fe area, I want to encourage you to stop by Agua Fria for a great eye full of gorgeous plants and amazing selections, and say hi to Bob. He's a very welcoming host. So thank you so
well,
much,
thank you.
Bob. Yep, and we'll talk with you later.
Okie doke.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.